everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Taylor Fain on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, American Ascendance and British Retreat in the Persian Gulf Region. Obviously, the book is extraordinarily timely. Americans are about to go to the polls to elect a new president, and issues relevant to the Persian Gulf loom very large because the United States is actively involved in the region militarily. I think that we're all very fortunate that Taylor has written this book, and I felt very honored to have the opportunity to talk to him about it. I know that I learned a lot, and I hope that you will as well. Here's the interview. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well today. It's actually very beautiful here in Iowa. We have a beautiful fall day. And where are you right now?
I am in Wilmington, North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Yeah, the Atlantic coast of North Carolina.
Well, it's always beautiful there, isn't it? That's what North Carolinians tell me, that it's the greatest place on earth.
It is. It's a very beautiful place.
Yeah. Well, I should tell our listeners that we're happy to have Taylor Fain on the show today, and we'll be talking about his new book, American Ascendance and British Retreat in the Persian Gulf Region. Obviously, it's a very timely book, and it should be read by everyone who is interested in diplomatic history and everybody who is going to vote. So that's a lot of people. Taylor, let me begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you were from, where you went to school, and how you became interested in diplomatic history and this topic in particular.
Okay. Well, I guess I had kind of a gypsy childhood. I was an Air Force brat, lived overseas a little bit in Greece, went to the University of Virginia as an undergraduate, double majored in history and foreign affairs, actually, and had no thoughts of becoming a historian as an undergraduate. Thought I would probably make a career in diplomacy. Went to Georgetown University, got my master's there from the School of Foreign Service. And from there, actually went to the State Department, where I was a State Department historian.
Oh, is that right? Were you really?
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a State Department historian right now.
Is that right?
In fact, yes, I do. He's that's very interesting. Can you just tell us a few words about what you did there?
Sure. Well, I did a number of things. I was in a section called the Office of Policy Studies, where we just prepared a lot of background materials for policymakers on various historical subjects. And then I worked as an editor of the Foreign Relations of the United States series for my last two or three years there, the big documentary history project.
Oh, yeah, I know it very well. It's a beautiful thing. It really is a beautiful thing.
Well, that was certainly something that taught me a lot about history and a lot about the archives and convinced me to be a historian.
Yeah, I can't imagine a better preparation for being a diplomatic historian than working on FRUS, as I call it. I don't know what you guys call it, FRUS or something.
FRUS,
but
exactly.
Yeah, because I've used it in my own work, oddly enough, and it is really, for those of our listeners who haven't seen it, it is an amazing thing. I mean, you really can read the history of American foreign policy through documents by just picking up any volume.
Yeah, you sure can.
It must have been amazing to work on that. Well, my hat's off to you guys for doing that. That's great. So,
well, it actually taught me a good deal about history, but it also taught me how many people in the State Department are actually trained as historians who aren't just State Department historians. One of the people I worked with was in the Office of Policy Planning and Coordination in the Bureau of Inter-American Affairs and was doing a project with him about Nicaragua, and he had his PhD in history from UNC Chapel Hill.
I remember
him saying to me, boy, you guys in the historian's office don't know how lucky you are to be able to sit back and look at the big picture.
Yeah, no, it's nice.
And, you know, that really struck me. That was true. And I kind of decided, you know, I do just want to look at the big picture.
Uh-huh.
Maybe my career lies elsewhere, maybe in academia. But one of the projects I worked on there was actually there during the first Gulf War. We were preparing all sorts of background studies for higher-ups in the department, and one of the things that I was charged with doing was writing a detailed chronology and analysis of American policy toward previous Iraqi claims on Kuwait. And during the time that I was preparing that study, it sort of introduced me to the whole history of British involvement in the Persian Gulf region. And I became pretty convinced that contemporary policymakers just don't properly appreciate the impact that the British presence there has had on contemporary American foreign policy.
Ain't it the truth?
And I think you're right. And especially the way British power fell apart there, and mm-hmm. and sort of American efforts to keep Britain involved in the Gulf for as long as possible, and mm-hmm. then to find surrogates for British power in the mm-hmm. Gulf after British finally left in 1971.
Yeah.
And I decided that when I returned to graduate school to get my doctorate, which was also at the University of Virginia studying uh-huh. with Melvin Loeffler, uh-huh. I decided to pursue that that subject.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's very interesting. I would like to I would like to use you as a contact for some of my students that are interested in going into
sure.
State Department service and this kind of thing, because you know I think that you know one of the things that very much recommends you to your students is that you actually have what I not so delicately call real world experience. And I have some of it too. I worked in a corporation for about 5 years and mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I'm able to tell them about what they need to do. And I think that you're exactly right about, you know, studying history in general. It does prepare you to do so many very worthwhile things. And I can't speak to the situation in North Carolina, but here at Iowa, it's often the case that, you know, young history students don't know about the possibilities in things like government service.
Well, that's very true. Yeah, there's lots of, you know, every federal agency seems to have their own historical office.
Absolutely, yeah.
The State Department, you know, the CIA has a pretty sizable mm-hmm. historical staff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just about every federal agency has their historical office with some really
exactly.
fine historians working
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and I tell my students about these places and also the analysis or intelligence departments that all the branches have, and mm-hmm. you know, State Department itself has. There's really quite a lot of work that can be done for, you know, by historians in government offices that I don't think that it's, at least out here, it's not widely recognized. But I, you know, I your students must just love the stories you probably tell about working in the State Department.
Yeah, that their ears perk up a little bit.
I imagine that they really do. Yeah, having a practitioner there, I'm sure they're extraordinarily glad to have you. I'll just tell them to pay you more right now. If the dean is listening, please pay Taylor more. Because he has more competency than his colleagues. And don't tell your colleagues I said that. So in any event, was this book started as your dissertation then?
It did. It mm-hmm. did. Yeah, it was a modified and expanded version of the dissertation, just like everybody's first book.
Yeah, mine was as well. No, that's exactly right. Although in my case, the press took so long to print it that my second book was out before my first one. Odd thing. But in any event, maybe you could tell me a little bit about the historiographical background for this particular topic, that is the American engagement with the Persian Gulf region and the British retreat. What had been written prior to your book?
Well, you know, it seemed to me that everything that had been written, or most things that had been written about the United States and the Gulf, it sort of tried to wedge the Persian Gulf itself into the larger geography of the Middle East, and mm-hmm. you would find it as, you know, a chapter or a subsection of a chapter about the larger relationship between the United States and the Middle East. And, you know, it's actually something that's quite distinct, and mm-hmm. I don't think you can really quite fit it in with discussions of the Arab-Israeli problem
yeah.
as well, although obviously it's related tangentially,
mm-hmm.
More than tangentially. But it struck me that it would have to be conceived as part of a much different geography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Peninsula, Southwest Asia, even the Indian Ocean and East Africa kind of form a geographic whole that I think American policymakers and certainly British policymakers thought of at the same time. There have been many good British histories of the period that relied almost exclusively on British archives. William Roger Lewis's British Empire in the Middle East, that covers the period from 45 to 51, is kind of the classic treatment of the area, and certainly influenced my work as well. You know, Michael Palmer, who used to be a U.S. Navy historian and now teaches at East Carolina, had written a good book called Guardians of the Gulf about U.S. policy in the Persian Gulf region. And there were lots of kind of smaller monographs about different episodes mm-hmm. and different sets of bilateral relations,
mm-hmm.
but no sort of overview, I mm-hmm. thought, of the United States and the Persian, the greater Persian Gulf region, including the Arabian Peninsula and the Indian Ocean and mm-hmm. even the Horn of Africa. So that's kind of where I saw my opportunity, and,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of encourage my readers to think of this new geography as they look at the Gulf.
Well, it was very interesting for me to read the book and see what postmodernists used to, not that I'm one of them, but postmodernists used to call the present absence, and that is, for American eyes, reading a book like this and not seeing Israel on every page is kind of shocking. And I kept looking for it to come up, and then I thought, well, this is obviously quite intentional that it is not brought up, that in fact this region has a coherence that I didn't really recognize. And I think the book does a terrific job of pointing that out, that there is a life separate from the Israeli question in this this area, and of course, mm-hmm. obviously, it subsisted forever before, the Declaration of Independence or the foundation of the Israeli state. So
yeah, that's true.
I thought it was very interesting in that way, because you really there's a story to be told that is entirely separate from the Israeli question almost.
Mm-hmm.
And
now they are related. And you know, any diplomat who's been in the Gulf since 1948 will tell you that they always get an earful from their Arab hosts. About Israel
mm-hmm.
and how it your Western country's relationship with Israel may very well shape your relationship with us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they tended to be pretty compartmentalized.
Yeah.
You know, where issues of oil and military facilities in Southwest Asia and the Gulf tended to be pretty discreet.
Yeah.
From the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Yeah. No, I see just what you mean. I mean, it is kind of fascinating. If I was thinking about this after reading your book, and if you think about American involvement, which we'll come to in a second, and the kind of special relationships that Americans developed after World War II with, on the one hand, Iran, and then Saudi Arabia and Israel, these places are entirely different. I mean, they're really very different cultures.
You're right.
And to
You're
think
right.
of them as a kind of whole is kind of crazy. It's a little bit like the category Asia. I'm never quite sure what Asia is, because it includes just everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a good category at all, and neither is, I think, our kind of folksy notion of the Middle East. That it just it's sort mm-hmm. of it's this broad swath of the world where bad things happen. I don't think Americans can generally be more specific about it than that. So
you know, one thing that I noticed was that the British Foreign Office, when you go through their files dealing with the region, you know, the United States it's evolved over the years, but basically a Bureau of Near Eastern, Middle Eastern Affairs for a long period of time that was in the same bureau with Africa, even.
Mm-hmm.
But the British had a separate Levant office, a separate Arabian office, and a separate sort of Eastern division,
mm-hmm.
you know, that dealt with different regions, sub-regions within the Middle East, because
mm-hmm.
they realized how different these regions were.
Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly right. So let's begin the story at the, I was going to say beginning, but of course it's never the beginning. Let's begin with British involvement in the Middle East. I guess it was in the 18th century. How did the British come to be involved there?
Well, the British have been there for a long time. You know, and the British just recently removed their troops from the city of Basra. There had been a British East India Company factory in Basra since the early 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
It was really the first place the British became involved there.
Mm-hmm.
The British really became involved in the Persian Gulf region during the era of the Napoleonic Wars. They were worried about French influence in the region, but they were more worried about local pirates that were preying on Indian shipping in the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
The Persian Gulf had always been an area that was important commercially to British India. It was always sort of a traditional seaborne invasion route for peoples attacking Indian territories. So the British became pretty concerned about the region and sent various naval expeditions to broker a truce between the warring factions in the region and put down the pirates. They eventually brokered a truce between the states, which came to be called the Trucial States, which are now
mm-hmm.
sort of the emirates that make up the modern United Arab Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a presence there since the early 19th century. But, you know, things changed. Their whole emphasis came to be more on the Russian threat to the Middle East, mm-hmm. Persia, and the area, and later on a sort of German interest in building a railroad from Constantinople down to the head of the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, oil, mm-hmm. of course, became of great interest as the Royal Navy converted to an oil-fueled branch of the service.
Mm-hmm.
So British interests were very old, and it evolved continually over the decades and over the centuries.
And what exactly is a this is a word that comes up again and again in the book and also in my own reading. I'm not a specialist on 18th or 19th century imperialism, at least in this area. What exactly is the legal status of a protectorate?
Well, that's a good question. It tended to vary from place to place in the Persian Gulf. Basically, they had a great deal of autonomy themselves, but agreed to let the British control their defense and their external relations.
Uh-huh.
And the British signed a number of these exclusive agreements with the various emirates in the Gulf region, most notably Kuwait in 1899.
Mm-hmm.
And to a large extent, the local rulers there were happy to sign these agreements because they saw the British as a counterbalance to Ottoman mm-hmm. power in the region, which mm-hmm. was fast disintegrating.
Yeah.
But they kind of saw the British as an important new patron in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And the British had these career diplomats, members of the Indian Political Service and later the Foreign Office, who kind of stood at the shoulders of these local rulers as mm-hmm. they made decisions. And encouraged them strongly to make decisions in accordance with British interests.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just about every place in the Persian Gulf region was nominally independent.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Indian Office and later the Foreign Office had responsibility for them. The only exception was the colony of Aden,
mm-hmm.
For which the British Colonial Office did maintain responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very complicated geopolitical. A geography. It's complicated ethnically as well, and it's kind of hard to get a handle on, especially for a sort of European historian such as myself who likes to think of nation states as kind of forming organically, and France appears, Germany is unified, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see the same processes in this area of the world.
No, you don't at all.
Yeah.
In fact, the issue of modern borders was introduced to the region by the British.
Mm-hmm.
Drawing borders in the sand
mm-hmm.
became a big preoccupation of the British.
Now, why don't you talk a little bit about that, because it's something that gets mentioned in the press occasionally, especially with reference to Iraq, and people will say mm-hmm. kind of offhandedly that Iraq was a creation of several British fellows in a room with a map and a red pencil. what is the status of that statement? What is the real story?
That's not too far off the mark. These areas were regions within the Ottoman Empire in the 18th and 19th
mm-hmm.
century and up until the end of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
The British assumed mandatory responsibility for a number of areas in the Middle East and drew up the borders of the Middle East
mm-hmm.
To comport with British interests, British economic and strategic
mm-hmm.
interests, in large part to ensure British access to oil and also to protect the routes to British India
mm-hmm.
as well. And that was certainly the case with Iraq, which was a combination of these three Ottoman vilayets or provinces of Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an artificial creation. But the interesting thing about the map of the modern Middle East is even though it was drawn by Europeans and had nothing to do with the local interests of Middle Easterners, the map of the Middle East has been remarkably durable.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the same borders exist
mm-hmm.
today as existed in 1920, with the
mm-hmm.
exception of Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, not true in Europe.
Not true in Europe.
No, not at all. No, we've got some shifting borders there.
Very fluid, yeah.
So what? So one of the sort of the big backdrop of your book is the decline of British power in the region. Why did British power decline in the region, and when did it start to decline?
Well, I think it really started to decline during the Second World War. Maintaining an empire is expensive,
mm-hmm.
and as the 20th century wore on. It was increasingly suspect morally in Britain,
mm-hmm.
And there were growing nationalist movements throughout the Middle East, throughout the Gulf region, who put up a fight. You know, who really took to heart this rhetoric from earlier in the century about
mm-hmm.
self-determination,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to cast off all sort of European influence and exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
Britain was, of course, financially drained by the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the first part of the Middle East where you saw the British begin to retreat, although very grudgingly, was in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
The British had been the patrons of the Saudi state from its inception. You know, they had drawn the borders of Saudi Arabia, and since the days of T.E. Lawrence, had a very good relationship with Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi state.
Mm-hmm.
But the Americans kept making inroads during the 1930s, winning an oil concession from the Saudi kingdom. And during the Second World War, when it became clear just how critically important Persian Gulf oil would be to prosecuting the war against the Axis and
mm-hmm.
also rebuilding Europe after the war,
mm-hmm.
the American government sort of decided that it would be in our interest and probably the interest of all of the West if the United States were to supplant the British
mm-hmm.
in the region,
mm-hmm.
which, as you can imagine, was not at all a popular decision with British diplomats,
mm-hmm.
particularly British diplomats in the field, in the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were very senior people in Whitehall who began to realize we can't manage this ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We need to, as Churchill was fond of saying, we need to get the Americans in
mm-hmm.
in the Middle East. The trick was going to be for the British, for the rest of their time in the region, you know, how to keep the Americans involved and how to use American power to support their interests rather than challenge their interests
mm-hmm.
in the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to keep the Americans from undermining them throughout the Gulf region as they had in Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
but at the mm-hmm. same time make sure the Americans did bear a lot of the financial and military responsibility for
mm-hmm.
Gulf defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the themes in your book, one of the things that surprised me was the reticence of Americans to become involved. Maybe I was reading you incorrectly, but it seems to me
at
every moment the British were trying to get the Americans involved in some way, particularly to support their military interests, and the Americans
mm-hmm.
said no.
They
said no. We're just not interested in this, and we're not going to come here. I think it's an instance of you know, as they say. I don't know if they say this in diplomatic history anymore, but either trade follows the flag, or the flag follows trade. And this was the flag follows trade in the American case, because American companies had been interested in this region since the discovery of oil.
Mm-hmm.
But the American government itself, you know, it took some positions on things like Arab nationalism that I imagine the British found very upsetting.
Oh, very, very. You know, one of the major themes throughout the book is the divergence of interest between the United States and Britain
mm-hmm.
in many key areas in the Gulf. It really surprised me to find that when I first started the project, I thought it would be a pretty straightforward, passing of the torch kind of story,
mm-hmm.
Britain to the United States. And it was much more complicated than that. The British did try to cling to their interests in the region till the very last possible moment, you know, at the end of 1971, and then
mm-hmm.
found informal ways to keep their
mm-hmm.
to preserve that influence. Many British policymakers were convinced that the Americans were trying to push them out. But what I found, when exploring the American documents was just how determined the Americans were not to accept this expensive new
mm-hmm.
responsibility
mm-hmm.
During the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, American resources were vast during the Cold War, but they weren't unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And American strategic planners relied on a division of labor between the Allies
mm-hmm.
For the defense of the Western world and defense of strategic assets.
Mm-hmm.
Like oil, and the Americans would love to have kept the British there as long as possible
mm-hmm.
to have direct responsibility for Persian Gulf defense.
Mm-hmm.
They diverged greatly on the whole issue of Arab nationalism
mm-hmm.
and Middle Eastern nationalism generally. The Americans always felt that the Soviet threat was the most important
yeah.
threat to the region.
Right.
The British always believed correctly that it would... The principal threat to Western interests in the region was anti-Western nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans were always afraid that the British would antagonize nationalist sentiment,
mm-hmm.
and that would open the door to further Soviet penetration of the region.
Yeah.
So they counseled the British regularly, you know, conciliate these nationalists,
yeah.
reach a deal with them,
yeah.
You know, give them half of what they want,
yeah.
Like, preserve as much of the Western presence in the area as possible.
Uh-huh.
And the British were just kind of furious. They thought this was our closest ally, and
yeah.
they're counseling us to bargain away our position here.
Yeah, I was going to say, it goes to kind of this moment of, at least one can perhaps tentatively speak of certain American political values or political culture. And, you know, a lot of the things that I read in your book sound awfully Wilsonian, that there was this kind of Wilson hangover, that Americans never seem to be able to let go of the notion of self-determination, even when it's really quite harmful to everybody's interest. The sort of very basic notion that people should decide their own fate, and particularly ethnic groups. And the Americans were always, you know, saying to the British, well, when are you going to let these people go? And the British mm-hmm. rule, well, we're not going to let these people go.
That's true. You know, the British always complained about the Americans viewing every nationalist movement in the Middle East as if they were the spiritual descendants of the American revolutionary
exactly.
generation.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And that every you know, and they thought the Americans just don't understand that these
yeah.
are not their you know their forefathers and another
yeah.
guys. They actually have interests that are contradictory to all
yeah.
of our interests
uh-huh.
and could be harmful to this. And they just thought this was another example of these you know kind of wet behind the ears
yeah.
Americans who didn't understand the complexities, the dangers of the region.
Yeah, it's interesting in a sense because it parallels what I think many professional historians know about our relationship with Israel, and that is, you know, we were quite happy that there would be an Israeli state. That's all well and good, but you know, after the Israeli state formed, we basically said to them, "Well, now you have to defend yourselves.
Right.
we're not going to do it for you. I mean, this is your deal. It's mm-hmm. it's your show. It's not ours." And you know,
it wasn't until the late '60s.
Yeah, we had profoundly ambivalent relationship with Israel about these things, and I just think Americans have forgotten this entirely. That there was long periods of times in which, you know, we thought that the Israelis were nothing but trouble and that they ought to take care of themselves. It was really only, and again, this kind of leads me to something I wanted you to talk about a little bit. It seems to me that having read your book that one might sensibly say that the thing that drew the Americans into the Persian Gulf and the Middle East generally was really the Soviet Union. And not anything else, and not the British. That the Soviet Union really carried the water by sort of antagonizing Native American anti-communism.
Well, that's true. That's true. There was a great fear that you know the Soviet Union would be able to threaten the natural resources of the Middle
mm-hmm.
East, and it was the oil of the Middle East. It is the oil of the Middle
mm-hmm.
East, in which the United States has a great example, not because. This is a point I always try to make to my students, not because the United States is so dependent on Persian Gulf oil,
mm-hmm.
because the United States actually consumes a relatively small percentage
yeah.
of Persian Gulf oil.
Yeah.
It's the fact that it's so important to Western Europe
yeah, that's right.
and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It was so important to post-war reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
It was so important to waging that Cold War with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
That drove the you know the United States to become more and more involved, and to think of the Persian Gulf really as part of its larger architecture of containment,
mm-hmm.
you know, defending those oil wells, making sure they didn't fall into the wrong hands,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was extremely important.
Whereas for
the British, it was their financial interest in
yeah.
the region and other more parochial interests.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point, and it's one that I think still. Needs to be revisited today, and that is that you know throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, 70s, I would even say, it wasn't as if the United States, at least as I read your book, really needed that oil very badly, but the British certainly did, and so did the Germans, mm-hmm. and so did the Japanese, and the Americans understood this as a kind of these were bricks in the larger wall of containment, so we needed to secure
yeah.
these resources for our allies.
Exactly.
I always get very frustrated when people you know say that. You know, what we do in the Middle East has to do with, you know, direct American needs. They fail to realize that most of our, if I'm not incorrect, most of our imported oil comes from Canada.
Canada, Mexico, and Saudi Arabia are very close to one another in the percentage of oil.
Right.
And people tend to forget that the United States produces almost half of oil.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is always forgotten. But the over the course of the British withdrawal or decline and the American ascendance, we developed some special relationships, quote-unquote, that are rather odd. Maybe you could talk a little bit about our long-term relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Sure. Saudi Arabia, beginning in about 1944-45, became America's most important ally in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
And its most important, along with Iran, its most important ally in the Persian Gulf region,
mm-hmm.
except for the British.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very difficult relationship. You know, we share very few common values,
mm-hmm.
political values, social values, I guess, with the Saudis, but
mm-hmm.
It's a relationship of mutual dependence.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi oil is valuable to the West,
mm-hmm.
and preserving the stability of international petroleum markets.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been allies of the Saudis since the 1940s, and time after time have offered a security guarantee to
mm-hmm.
the Saudis. Most recently in 1990 and 91,
mm-hmm.
With Operation Desert Shield,
mm-hmm.
And Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
That was the great fear, obviously, of Saddam Hussein taking over Kuwait, was that he was that close to the Saudi oil fields.
Yeah, right.
And if he could control both the Saudi and the Kuwaiti oil fields,
mm-hmm.
Then it could jeopardize the structure of petroleum markets in the world.
Yeah, I find the relationship very interesting in a number of ways, and one is that I can understand the special relationship between the United States and Great Britain. We speak the same language and have largely the same culture. But I've had friends that have worked in Saudi Arabia, and there is no more un-American place, perhaps with the exception of North Korea, than Saudi Arabia. It is nothing like the United States. Nothing.
No, it's an absolute monarchy.
Yeah, right.
one of the last in the world.
Yeah, I know. It's a very odd thing. We don't really, and it's quite remarkable. We should all give credit to American diplomats for maintaining that relationship against, I always wonder, was it the case that Arab nationalism didn't get the better of the Saudis when it did get the better of the Egyptians and the Syrians and so on? I don't know. Do you know the answer to that question?
Why did it not get the better?
Well,
there was a great deal of effort put into supporting the Saudis as sort of a counterweight to anti-Western kind of secular Arab nationalism
mm-hmm.
in the 1950s and 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And people tend to forget that actually in the early 50s, the Saudis got along surprisingly well with Nasser's Egypt and provided a lot of the money for a lot of Nasser's anti-Western subversive activities
uh-huh.
in the area. But then it became sort of clear to the Saudi king that Nasser was eventually going to be gunning for him as kind of a symbol of the old order.
Right.
And he became more and more disenchanted, and the United States began to sort of set him up as the, an opposite pole
mm-hmm.
to anti-Western secular nationalism
mm-hmm.
in the region.
Mm-hmm.
I have a graduate student now who's doing some excellent work on Saudi Arabia as being set up as, the keeper of the holy places
mm-hmm.
and a rallying point for Islam around the world, pro-Western Islam.
Pro-Western Islam, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. Now let's talk a little bit about Iran, and I think, most of what Americans remember about Iran comes from the hostage crisis
sure.
incident, and then they might be aware that there was a war between Iran and Iraq. I don't really know, but I'm fascinated by this particular episode because Iran is a very different sort of place than, say, Afghanistan or Iraq or Saudi Arabia. It's a very
mm-hmm.
ancient culture. It's a very interesting sort of locale. Many Americans know Iranians. I know
sure.
many Iranians, and they're remarkably sophisticated people. They tend to be very cosmopolitan. Their religion tends to be much more moderate. Maybe you could explain to us exactly how we became involved with the Iranians.
Sure. Well, that goes back to the early 1950s. Actually, goes back to the Second World War. Iran was sort of a conduit for Western aid to the Soviet Union
mm-hmm.
During the war, and had been divided between the British and the Soviets during the period. It had always been an area of British influence
mm-hmm.
To the point where the Iranians deeply resented British economic control in their country. Anglo-Iranian Oil, which is now BP, had an enormous facility in southern Iran that was nationalized by the Iranians in the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. And after a two-year standoff, the British and the Americans eventually cooperated to depose Mohammad Mossadegh, the nationalist prime minister of Iran.
And that was in 1956? That was
in 53.
53,
that
I'm
was
sorry. 53, yeah. Okay, yeah.
After which the British lost their monopoly on Iranian oil,
mm-hmm.
and at American insistence accepted a multinational consortium in the region, which the United States had a great deal of, had a great share of the interest. And America, again, set up the Shah of Iran as a kind of a pole of pro-Western stability in the region. His country bordered the Soviet Union. He was very pro-Western, although he wasn't above playing off the Soviets and the United States against each other on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, the Iranians, ethnically Persian, are very sophisticated, very cosmopolitan, and really sort of looked down their nose at the Arabs across on the other side of the Gulf.
Yeah.
One of the great strategy the United States had in the wake of Britain's withdrawal from the region was to encourage the Saudis and the Iranians to be what the Nixon administration called the twin pillars
mm-hmm.
of pro-Western stability in the region.
Mm-hmm.
What they failed to understand was that they viewed each other more as rivals in the mm-hmm. region than as allies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great quote in my book from the American ambassador in Tehran, Armin Meyer, who said that, you know, was basically outlining why the Iranians kind of looked down on the Arabs. They thought they were culturally inferior,
mm-hmm.
and he said, and of course there's always the kind of fight over a shared inheritance, you know, when the British left, that would make sure that they remained adversaries rather
mm-hmm.
than important allies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know that I had a number of contacts. This is actually in the 1990s. That is people that I worked with, senior historians who worked in the area, who were invited to Iran in the 70s, actually, at the behest of the Shah, to come help set up the Iranian system of higher education, and they describe just truly lavish building projects. And just absolutely remarkable things that were being done there under the Shah. Of course, in the context of this general repression, but this kind of huge modernizing effort that was funded by oil money, and how they worked hand in glove with the United States. And then, of course, it all fell apart for reasons which I guess we don't have to go into. So one of the things as you point out in the book is that once the British decided to withdraw, I guess it was in the mid-60s that they started to make motions in this direction. This rather upset the Americans. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, you know, the United States was bogged down in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
increasingly in the 60s, and Persian Gulf oil did supply a lot of the American military effort
mm-hmm.
in Southeast Asia. There was this general feeling that you know, the United States can't come to the rescue of the Persian Gulf region if the British decide to leave here. We can't step into their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the Johnson administration made every effort to encourage the British, please remain there as long as you can. You know, whereas the British felt that they had been getting sort of lukewarm support from the Americans in the region for years,
mm-hmm.
now all of a sudden the Americans were pleading with them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it came as a great a shock to the Johnson administration when the Wilson government in Britain, the Labour government,
mm-hmm.
Formally announced that you know, they were going to withdraw the last British troops from the area
mm-hmm.
by the end of 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And I described this very famous meeting that the British Foreign Secretary George Brown had in Washington in January 1968, shortly before the Wilson government formally made the announcement that it would be withdrawing its troops from the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
It sent the Foreign Secretary to meet with higher-ups in the Johnson administration to give them the heads up, to let them know this was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And George Brown met first with Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, mm-hmm. who was known as this very courtly Southern gentleman. And he was just furious with George Brown. The quote that came out of that, that's been quoted in many different places, in both the British and the American memoranda of conversation, and then various cabinet diaries, memoirs. Rusk looked at George Brown and said, "For God's sake, act like Britain."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which I thought just spoke volumes about what America expected of its ally.
Yeah, yeah. We weren't exactly treating the British like equals at this point, I think.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And the British felt that very, very keenly.
Yeah, I mean, one might imagine they said, you know, "We warned you about this, that this could get out of hand, and you didn't pay attention to us, that, you know, if you had a stronger mm-hmm. presence in the area, then you wouldn't be so worried now." Because obviously things were sort of heating up, especially in the late 60s, with, you know, the 67 War and then the Yom Kippur War. This must have changed the status of Israel in the eyes of American policy planners as well.
It did indeed. It did indeed. And this was going on at the same time that Britain was suffering so greatly financially that it just, you know, it eventually ended up devaluing the pound by 20% at the end of 1967. Wilson himself, who had been thought to have been kind of on the left of the Labour Party, was actually kind of outflanked on his left by some of his cabinet members who were increasingly demanding, you know, that it end this sort of imperial project in the Middle East,
uh-huh.
just morally reprehensible in the eyes of many of his own cabinet members.
Uh-huh.
And these things kind of came together. They had suffered during the, you know, there was an oil embargo, an oil cutoff during the 1967 war. And later on in 73, it was, again, oil cut off by the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries within OPEC of any Western country that was thought to have given aid to the Israelis during that war.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, the British, you know, really felt like they were between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it did change the relationship between the United States and Israel at this point. Was it the case that the Israelis were had sort of their stock had risen in the eyes of the Americans? When is this the cliche that everybody knows is our aircraft carrier in the Middle East? Was this at the moment at which Israel became our aircraft carrier in the Middle East?
The Middle East. Well, you know, and shortly thereafter, the United States became increasingly alarmed at the amount of Soviet aid that was given to the Arab government fighting in the region, and, you know, against Israel in 1967.
Yeah.
The United States had been pretty content to let the French supply a lot of Israel's military needs, although the French were beginning to understand that you know, the Arab oil would not be forthcoming if they kept supplying military goods to the Israelis. So they had cut that off earlier in the decade.
Yeah.
And the United States found itself moving more squarely behind Israel.
Yeah. We needed them at that point. It is funny you mentioned about the weaponry and so on and so forth, because I know if you see pictures, I'm kind of a military history buff myself. If you see pictures of the 67 and 72 war, especially the 67 war, and you actually see what kind of equipment the Israeli had, it was very often American surplus from World War II.
Well, you know, 1967, you saw a lot of the first thing you see in the old newsreel footage are French fighter planes.
Yeah, no, that's right.
But by 1973, it's the American fighter planes.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And then by 72, of course, the Egyptians and the Syrians were armed with the most advanced Soviet weapons. And of course, they did relatively well. I mean, one weapon in particular I can tell you about is they had wire guided anti tank missiles, which were really quite something at the time, and they shocked the heck out of the Israelis. And the Israelis, you know, had to, you know, they really needed a certain amount of force modernization at that point, because they were, you know, while they weren't defeated, they certainly were not handed a resounding victory.
Mm-hmm.
So then by 72, the British have withdrawn, and
that's right.
What is the American position at that time? And maybe you could just take us. I know this is outside the parameters of the book, but for those listeners that would be interested, maybe you could take us, if you'd be willing, from 72 to more or less the present. How does the American relationship in this area with the Arab countries develop?
The Americans had decided to continue with the Johnson administration policy of encouraging Saudi-Iranian cooperation, and the Nixon administration especially concentrated on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Iran became the recipient of huge amounts of American military aid in the 1970s, and this really fit in with the whole the Nixon doctrine of providing military and technical assistance to our allies in key regions of the world, but
mm-hmm.
expecting them to provide the military manpower to defend themselves in the region. And this fit in beautifully with the Shah's vision of the role that Iran should play in the Persian Gulf region as essentially kind of the sheriff of the region and a great regional hegemon.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very pleased. Richard Nixon traveled to Tehran in May of 1972 on his way home from his summit in Moscow with Brezhnev. And one of the interesting things he said to the Shah, he and Henry Kissinger had basically signed off or agreed to sign off on providing the Shah with just about anything he wanted in the way of military goods. And at the end of his final meeting with the Shah, Richard Nixon leaned across the table and said to the Shah, "Protect me."
Which is an
interesting way to put it.
He
really was looking to the Shah to provide the front line of American defense in the Persian Gulf. So the United States, continued to, during the 1970s, for as long as they could, to encourage Saudi Arabia, but more so Iran, to be this sort of bulwark of pro-Western stability and defense of the Gulf. And when the Shah's government came crumbling down in 1978, it left the United States with really no option but to become involved directly on a large scale, politically and diplomatically and even militarily in the Gulf. Jimmy Carter in his State of the Union address in 1980 articulated the so-called Carter Doctrine, which said that the oil fields in the Middle East were a vital interest of the United States, and that the United States would do whatever was necessary to defend them. And from then on, you saw the United States more involved militarily in the Gulf, reflagging Kuwaiti oil tankers in the 80s, engaging in a small-scale naval war with the Iranians in the late 80s as well, and supporting Saddam Hussein's Iraq against Iran, because they viewed the spread of radical Islam in the region as a more potent threat, a more immediate threat to Western and American interests than Saddam Hussein was at the time.
That is an odd and forgotten alliance, I think.
It's very strange. I show my students in class this fuzzy photo of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein in 1983 or 1984.
Right.
And I always sort of explain it by telling them about Lord Palmerston's victim, that Britain had no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, only permanent interests.
Yeah, exactly.
Things could be very fluid politically.
That's interesting, because this provides a kind of general background, I think, that our listeners would be interested in for the defense of Kuwait in the first Gulf War. This didn't come out of nowhere.
No, not at all. They had been, reflagging these Kuwaiti ships for a few years. I can't remember what the name of the operation was called, but there'd been the idea that we have to protect the flow of oil from the region. The Kuwaitis had actually been leaning kind of toward the political left in the 80s, as I recall, but of course there's no more pro-American country in the world now.
Right? Mm-hmm. No, I imagine that's
has
true.
Been in the last 18 years.
And so how did it, when we defended Kuwait and was it Operation, what did they call it?
Desert Storm.
That was Desert Storm, yes. How did this ripple through the area at the time diplomatically?
It created a lot of sort of untenable conditions. We now know it resulted in a large American military presence in Saudi Arabia, which was one of the chief grievances of Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda, that this American military force was defiling the land that housed the holy sites.
And where were they? Where were they based? Were they based on the Iraqi border, or where?
Where were they? It was the huge military complex, which was just closed down in the last two or three years. I think it was the King Fahd Air Base, and I'm not certain what part of the country it is. It's away from most population centers, I believe. Resulted in the creation of, or the recreation of, the U.S. Fifth Fleet with its headquarters in Bahrain.
That's right, yes.
and large-scale American military bases that are still in places like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Qatar. There's a sizable, it's a much larger military presence, American military presence there now than the British ever had in the region. At its height, I believe, in the Gulf, the British only had about 8,000 troops, and that was considered untenable, and even though it wasn't all that expensive to maintain. But the American military presence there now is much larger.
And how is the case, this is something I think that our listeners would be interested in, and I know I am, is it that we talked about this a little bit before, but Iraqi claims on Kuwait are hardly new.
That's right. They go back to at least the 30s and probably before. You know, there was the first Kuwait crisis was actually in 1961, just after the British had given Kuwait its full independence. The Iraqis began to make threatening sounds and move troops, or said they were moving troops toward the border with Kuwait. And the British had to launch a military operation, land troops again in Kuwait for several weeks or several months in the face of this perceived threat. It turned out the threat was actually a little overblown. This is not a new thing at all.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then we should probably mention, of course, this. It's one of the great forgotten military conflicts of the 20th century, and that is the Iraq-Iran War. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how that impacted American diplomatic interests in the area.
Well, people tend to forget because we didn't see it on our television screens every night, but it was a war fought on an enormous scale.
Yeah.
I believe there were more than 1 million people killed during the course of an eight-year war between Saddam Hussein and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Huge-scale battles, and the United States did end up giving intelligence support and some material support to Saddam Hussein as a counterweight to Iranian influence in the region, including financial credits and some of the basic components that later Saddam converted into chemical weapons that he used against Iranians and against some of his own people, which were much in the news over the last decade or so,
I think it is one of these things that it fell off the radar of Americans that this was going on at all. I mean, it's very confusing if you just see pictures of it, because again, I'm kind of a student in military history, and if you look at the Iraqi forces, they're of course armed by, they're our allies, and they're armed by the Soviets, and you look at the Iranians, and they're our enemies, and they're armed by us. kind of a strange thing. So
strange.
Let me ask you. Our time is getting short, but I really want to hear what you have to say about two questions: what you think will happen in the Persian Gulf, and what you would like to see happen.
Oh gosh!
You can feel free not to answer those questions if you
those
want.
Those are very hard. You know, as a recovering political scientist and historian now, I'm always a little leery of prognosticating.
Sure. Yeah.
I try to help. I try to help my readers and students see the context in which current events are playing out. But prognosticating may be a little beyond my.
I can put the question a little bit differently. If John McCain or Barack Obama's transition team calls you, as well they should, and says, Taylor, we'd like to have someone come give us a report as to what we should do, what would you say to them? You probably say no, I'm not coming. But if you did, we're compelled by greater patriotic interest. What would you say to them? What should happen?
Well, there is a way to there is a way to encourage liberalization in the area, if not democratization in the area, that did not necessarily involve introducing American combat forces to the region. That the United States needs to help promote its liberal values and liberal political institutions, perhaps more through example and through education than perhaps using military tools. And I think, you know, this is the lesson that the British learned 80, almost 90 years ago, that the Americans failed to learn in the last 5 or 6 years, is that, you know, American military forces in the region tend to be incendiary foreign military forces in the region. And perhaps more of an impediment to the United States pursuing its interests there than anything else.
Yeah, this is a very difficult situation. I had the great good fortune to interview a fellow who was both a military advisor between 1970 and 73 in Vietnam, and then went on to write a book about the American withdrawal from Vietnam. His name's James Wilbanks. Actually, if listeners are interested, there's an interview with him on the site. And, you know, he had some very interesting things to say about how difficult it is to withdraw from a place like this, how there really are no really good choices, militarily or politically, that you have to make here. Because we have dependents now in Iraq. I mean, we have people that work for us. And, you know, there's the more general kind of what is sometimes called the pottery barn doctrine. You know, we broke it, we bought it. And you know, I don't think anyone exactly knows what we should do now. I really don't.
Right.
There's no easy answer to this.
One of the things that I try to bring out in the book is that while Western countries have tried to pursue their interests in the region, you know, the peoples of the region have their own agendas. They have their own interests that long predate Western interests there.
Yeah.
And you know, they're trying to pursue those at the same time, you know, complicating the playing field while the United States and Britain were trying to pursue their Cold War and late imperial interests.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, whoever sits in the Oval Office next January is going to have their hands full, I think.
They certainly are.
It's really quite a mess. So, Taylor, we've taken up a lot of your time, and we really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating conversation. Let me close with what has been our traditional question here on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, I'm kind of moving out of the Persian Gulf and into the Indian Ocean with my next project. I'm working on sort of an international history of the British Indian Ocean Territory and the large American military facility on the island of Diego Garcia.
Diego Garcia. That's a very interesting story. Yeah.
A very interesting story, and trying to fit it into the kind of a larger picture of Indian Ocean studies
It's
a very vital field in Foundation history these days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, I've talked to the burgeoning field of world history looks at things like that. Broad regions of the world that we don't ordinarily group in our kind of nation state centric model.
Right.
Well, I fully expect that the transition teams of either the Obama or the McCain campaigns will be calling you soon, and I hope that they do.
Well, I'll be sitting by my phone.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we've been talking to Taylor Fain about his new book, American Ascendance and British Retreat in the Persian Gulf Region. It's a fantastic book, and I highly counsel everyone to go get it and read it, especially if you are planning on voting, and I hope that you are. So, Taylor, thanks very much for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Taylor Fain, author of American Ascendance and British Retreat in the Persian Gulf Region. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a good week.